I'm Bucky, I'm alcoholic. This is going to maybe a real short talk because I want to, you know, maybe after like 5 or 10 minutes I may end so we can go home and watch the New England Patriots beat. I mean, watch the Super Bowl. That's what I meant to say. Outside issue, I have no opinion. my sobriety date is June 14th, 1991. And let's see. Yeah, I should introduce myself as I'm Bucky. I'm a pig because I ate, drank, snorted, crammed, jam, rammed everything into my body I could. And but I'll talk about the alcoholic part of me. That's not original. Patio said it one time. I always wanted to use that. It's good to be here. Thanks for asking me to speak. Whoever asked me, wherever he is, there he is. Yeah, it's his fault. I've been here a couple times to speak before, so it's good to be back. And my friend Helen rode up with me, and her husband's wondering where she is, but she's with me, so she's all right. golly, I don't know. I haven't spoken in a while. Let's see what happens. I grew up in Cumberland County. It's a little, small, poor county. It's between Powhatan and Buckingham counties on Route 60, if that gives you any clue. But I grew up on a tobacco farm. We had milk cattle, and we had hogs, and we had, so many things. It was really sort of fun growing up on a farm in the country. It's always something fun to do. Every day was a new experience. I remember being lonely, though. And there weren't too many kids my age in the area where I grew up. And I remember when I went to school, I thought it was so cool because I got to actually see people, you know, instead of animals. And, but, you know, my problem started early on. I could have used the bourbon on the rocks in the first grade because I had problems right from the get-go with this thing called school. I mean, I did well. That wasn't the problem. But I was always, the teacher didn't like me. You know, the teacher had it out for me. The teacher would move me from desk to desk to desk to desk. You know, that type of students. You know, I was always getting moved. Everywhere I moved, I'd make friends easily and start talking and became chatty. And the teacher said I was a discipline problem, so they kept moving me around. Finally, they just moved me to the principal's office. I remember on the bus, I got written up on the bus every day by the school bus monitor. And when I get to school, the school bus monitor would turn my name into the principal, and I'd always get called to the principal's office. Well, the thing with that is my brother was the school bus monitor, so I never did think that was very fair. So everybody was out to get me, you know. Poor little me. I had always felt like I was on the outside looking in. I always, you know, felt like I wasn't good enough. I felt like I didn't have friends. Nobody liked me, I felt. And that wasn't really the case, so that's the perception that I had. I would do anything to make you like me. I was the kid that would, you know, cut up in class just to get the attention and just silly stuff like that. And I remember many a teacher running out of the classroom crying because I'd made them cry, and I didn't understand what their problem was. You know, they didn't think it was funny or something. I don't know. But I thought, well, maybe I always got really good grades, and I thought maybe if I got bad grades, people would like me better. So I started getting all, you know, like F's or E's or whatever they called them in grade school. So I thought maybe the kids would like me if I got all bad grades instead of always getting the best grades. Well, that didn't work either. So I just remember always trying to do something to make you like me. I'll say again, I always felt like I was on the outside looking in and never measured up, wasn't good enough. And so that followed me up through in high school. I did really well. I still didn't drink. I was a late bloomer. I know most people start drinking at 13. I don't know where that age came from, but most people I hear at speaker meetings started at 13. I was 18 before I had my first drink. I was in high school. I got really good grades, and I was like in all the clubs and all the activities, and you know, it was just that type of person. You know, it was in all the stuff. And I got a scholarship to go to college in Williamsburg, and I still hadn't had a drink. I mean, I might have had a half of a sip of a glass of wine at Christmas. I don't know. But I really hadn't started drinking. My friends had started drinking, experimenting with alcohol. And I could have, because I would get invited to all the parties. But most of the times I wouldn't go. I would just stay home and study or something. But I was always, my father, I remember when I was a senior in high school, he said, "You're 18, you don't drink, do you?" I said, "No." He says, "Well, it's a good thing with your personality, you'd probably become an alcoholic." Well, you know, that was a pretty prophetic statement, you know, it's like, and I always had this intuitively that if I drank, I'd become an alcoholic. My alcoholism was really rampant in my mother's side of the family. I was telling Helen today that one side of my mom's side of the family, they're all bootleggers from Appomattox County, and they all died drunks, so I don't think they're bootlegging anymore. But I had an uncle, my mom's brother died. He lived in New York, and I used to go up to New York every summer and spend my summer on Long Island in Babylon, New York with my uncle and his family, and he was an alcoholic, and I got to see him lose everything. They had a I remember having a ball up there. I just remember I loved New York, and it just seemed so cool that I just thought he wasn't really like, he was still flying high at this time, and he was a blue-collar worker at an airplane factory out on Long Island somewhere, and each weekend, he and all his friends would have a house, they call them house parties. And everybody would gather at one person's house this weekend and have, and it was just a big drunk, you know, and they'd all fall in the pool if they had a pool. And, you know, it was just a lot of fun. They'd play records and drink and dance and have a good time. And I just thought that was so cool. When I graduated from high school, I went to college, and my freshman year, I took my first drink. I was 18. I took my first drink. Like I said, I was a late bloomer, and I loved it. And I remember that warm feeling, that warm glow, you know, that feeling that I saw the rest of my drinking career. You know, I just remember how I felt. I just remember I remember I was funny, and I made people laugh, and I was like the you know, I could just like the life of the party, and I liked that feeling. I didn't really drink. I remember my freshman year, I studied really hard, and I didn't really drink anymore. Maybe until that the summer after my freshman year, I remember I partied a little bit, and I still hadn't really gotten drunk, but I'd been drinking a little bit, and I loved it. Probably in the beginning of my sophomore year, I got drunk for the first time. I remember I was drinking whiskey sours, and I was trying to impress this rich girl from West End, Richmond. And I guess I impressed her. Right. I got really drunk and made a fool of myself and threw up all over the place. And that was my first. I remember all my friends were trying to sober me up, and they were throwing water all over me, and it was just like, you know, it was just awful. I remember feeling bad for the next day or two, and I remember thinking, well, you know, the problem here is bourbon, so I won't drink bourbon anymore. So I started drinking beer, and pretty much stuck with beer, and I started drinking on the week, just about each weekend. You know, they had fraternity parties, and I joined a fraternity. The summer after my sophomore year, my brother got married, and there was a lot of partying going on. And my brother was a daily drinker, but he wasn't an alcoholic. He was a heavy drinker. He drank for the fun of it, and he didn't have to drink. he wasn't an alcoholic of the hopeless variety like I am. But anyway, we had a lot of partying that summer, and I just drank pretty much beer every night. And I remember one Sunday night, there was no party, and I remember I need a beer, man. You know, it's like, wow. And I realized that. I said, this doesn't sound too good. You know, I need a beer, you know. And, but I just sort of passed it off. I don't know if I got one or not. I probably went to the refrigerator and got one, but, I just remember I'd gotten into that habit of drinking, about 4 to 6 beers each night. And I remember the last 2 years of college, I drank, during the week, I drank daily. I drank 4 to 6 beers each night. And on the weekends, I went, you know, hog wild because I was in a fraternity. So we drank pretty hard and heavy. And I remember I could drink everybody else under the table. I was in a football fraternity, and I didn't play football, but I could drink all the football players under the table, and they had a reputation for being big drinkers and big partiers, and they were amazed at my, you know, how much I could drink. And but I still didn't think anything about it. You know, I remember the summer before my senior year, I remember talking to somebody and laughing about, well, you know, I guess we're alcoholics, ha, ha, ha. And I don't know if I don't think I really was serious. It was just sort of like a joke, but there was a little bit of seriousness to it, you know. I mean, the thought was there, you know, I was thinking about it. After I graduated from college, let's see, well, I met this girl, and she had just graduated from Duke, and she was getting ready to go back to Duke to go to medical school, and the wheels in my alcoholic brain started to turn. I was thinking, doctors make a lot of money, you know, and she could take care of me, and I could just watch TV, watch the soap operas, and sip on my beers all day long and have a good life, you know. And I said, all I got to do is get her to fall in love with me. And I got her to fall in love with me, and the plan just about worked. Well, I did get her to marry me. We got married, and we stayed married for about 3 years, maybe four, I can't remember. We were down in Durham, North Carolina, and she was in med school. She was spending all her time in the medical school library, and I was like, I was in graduate school, too. I was getting a master's in Spanish because that was my major undergraduate, so I had to do something, you know. I didn't want to work, so I had to do something. So, you know, I was a good student. I could get A's and stuff, so I did that, but I didn't have to study as hard as she did, so I had my evening spree to drink and be lonely, and I got a resentment, and I told her, I said, look, you're spending all your time in the medical school library, and I said, I'm getting a little resentful here. You're never here with me. And she didn't drink, but I just wanted, you know, some company, and so I said, well, I gave her an ultimatum. I said, you have to choose. It's either medical school or me. And she, guess which one she chose? Didn't take rocket science to figure that one out. So then I said, well, I was just kidding. I didn't mean it. And she said, no, you're gone. So she said, you're an alcoholic. I'm afraid you're an alcoholic. I've done a little research, and you seem to drink alcoholically, and I don't want you in my life anymore. So out I went. What I did was I finished the master's, so I said, well, I don't really want to work anymore. So I got a fellowship to get a doctorate at UNC Greensboro, UNC Chapel Hill, in Romance languages. And I was going to, and I had studied seven languages. So, again, school had always been easy for me, especially with foreign languages. That was just my forte and my interest. So, but something had happened. I started drinking a lot more, and I started drinking a lot more than I had before, and it took a lot more for me to get to that place, you know what I mean, if you're an alcoholic. And what happened was I started getting these fears started, I just felt like I was just like terrified all the time. It's like, what am I doing, this little hick from a tobacco farm, doing it in a doctoral program at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill? I mean, this is a joke, you know. Today's going to be the day they find out I don't know what I'm doing, you know. And I always felt like, you know, I always had that doom and gloom, like, you know, the ceiling was going to fall in on me, and they were going to find out I didn't know what I was doing. I actually did know what I was doing, but I just had the fear that I didn't know what I was doing. And I was just always full of fear and so, you know, terrified all the time and so unhappy. I was just full of self-pity, you know, all the feelings that we have. And I remember, it wasn't hard. It was easy, but I just couldn't do it anymore. And I was teaching, and I just couldn't get up. I remember I'd crawl to the phone and call one of my students and say, Mr. Senior Smith is sick today. Can you go please put a note on the door that we're not going to have class this morning? You know, and I just couldn't do it anymore. And actually, just bunked out is what happened. I just couldn't do it, you know. And I, I mean, it's such a waste because God gave me this talent, you know, and I had all these opportunities and these wonderful opportunities to use my talents and my brains, and I just drank it away, you know. And a month later, I was working in a 7-Eleven store, you know. That's, you know, my resume is a joke. If you look at my resume, a drunk's resume is a joke, but if you look at mine, it makes no sense. 1978, teaching at the University of North Carolina. 1979, clerk 7-Eleven. You know, it's like, what? What's going on here? There's some mistake, Mr. Smith. I know there's a mistake here. And then I got a job teaching. I taught for a while, and I was drinking alcoholically, and I became that teacher. Every school had one back in the day. I was the one that drank with the students, and the students loved me, you know. And I even drank too much. And they said, please, Mr. Smith, don't get drunk tonight. Because I'd get drunk, and then I'd come in, and I'd get jacked up on coffee, and I'd be, like, wired, and I'd scream at them and cuss at them. And they just laughed at me anyway. But I was real popular. I would give them an assignment. And I remember one day I was sitting on the edge of the table, and I passed out or blacked out or something, but I fell into the trash can. And the kids left me in there, and they would just sort of like quietly tiptoe out of the room. And I don't know, but I did give them beers, and they were happy, and I just gave them all A's. I'd come in. It got really bad towards the end because I couldn't speak. I got so bad off that I couldn't talk. And I couldn't speak in Spanish or English. So what I would do is I'd crawl into the classroom, and my hands would be shaking so bad that I'd have to take a drink, but they'd still be shaking, and I'd just write an assignment on the board. And my right handwriting, because of the shakes, was so bad, they couldn't read it. And I just didn't say anything. Then I would just sit down, and I'd hear one of them say, he's drunk again, you know. Sometimes they'd go tell another teacher or the principal, or they'd come in and just to look at me. And but you know what? They never threatened to fire me. This assistant principal came to me as a friend and said, "We know we hear you're drinking a lot, and is there a problem? And I'm coming as a friend, and you're not in trouble, but you might want to take a look at your drinking." I was. Let's see, what year is this now? Oh, okay, 1991 is when I got sober, and at the end, you know, I was just drinking for oblivion, and I was just, I would make it to school. I remember I was always late, and I never worked a full week, and they never said anything to me. I remember I looked at my, they give you like 10 sick days and 3 business days, and I had 21 sick days in the first semester, and you know, it's just like they never said anything to me. I mean, if you go over that, you don't get paid very much. They take it out of your paycheck. But they were, I guess, enabling me because they never, you know, said anything to me. But it was getting towards the end, and I knew it. I just couldn't do this anymore. And it was just a night like any other night. I'd had about 6-pack or so and a few glasses of wine. And, well, at the end I was drinking, I was drinking a case of beer, 2 big bottles of wine, a fifth of bourbon, and a handful of Xanax. And that was what I ate. That was my meal. And there was just one night, you know, I don't know, it was about 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, I don't know, it was just something happened. It was like a moment of, just that moment of clarity came over me. And I've been wanting to stop drinking for a long time. I've been trying to stop for years. And I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not know there was a place to go for help. I'd heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't know, you know, that you could get help there. I just thought it was a place where, I guess I'd seen it in a movie. I just thought it was a place where old people went and smoked cigarettes and drank coffee and shook for an hour and then went back home and drank. I didn't know that there was a place for help, you could get help. I had not a clue. And then this moment of clarity, and I saw my life as it really was. I'd seen it from, you know, from when I was a teenager, you know, and a good church member and a good student and real popular and, I don't know, sang in the church choir and did all these things and seen my life as it, you know, gone downhill. And I didn't like what I saw. And I remember I started crying and looked for my Bible and found my Bible that I never read, and I blew the dust off and tried to find some passages that I had read in, from my childhood in church. And I got on my knees and I begged God to let me, to help me. I didn't want to live like this anymore. And I fell asleep the next morning. And, you know, I've heard this story from so many alcoholics, is that God, please help me prayer, you know. And I really meant it with all my heart. And the next morning I woke up and the thought popped into my mind to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know where there was a meeting. It was really weird. I made a series of phone calls, and I was drinking. I still had some alcohol in the house, and I had a few drinks, I think. It was real hazy. But I remember I finally found a person that knew a person that knew a person that was an alcoholic. So I finally got a hold of this alcoholic, and they said, there's a meeting tonight. And it turned out it was exactly one block from my apartment. And it's like, wow, you know, that was like, well, I can't go there because it's too far. I couldn't use that as an excuse. You know, so I staggered into the meeting, I remember. And I was just like, you know, you've seen the newcomer come in that's probably hyped up on something. You know, they're not really quite sober yet, but they probably still have something in their system. And they a little inappropriate comments, or they... I was too chatty, or I was raising my hand, or I don't know, just some, you know, the body language. They could tell that I was, something wasn't quite right, and they kept asking me, are you all right, are you all right? And I was, you know, pretty much sober. I was a little offended they kept asking me, was I all right? But what happened was I had a seizure in the middle of the room, and they had to take me to the hospital. And that was the last day I drank, and that was June 14th. Well, I guess that was the 13th, the last day I drank, 1991, and ended up at St. John's Hospital in Richmond, West End Richmond, on River Road. I guess it's actually in Goochland County. It's not there anymore. But it was a Catholic hospital. It was part of Bon Secours, of course. And it was I stayed there, and my insurance paid for 12 days, and I was in detox for 10 of those 12 days. I don't know. I don't remember a whole lot, but I remember they said to go to 90 and 90. And when I got out, I started going to AA meetings. And I was going to meetings in all over Central and Southside Virginia. And I was going to a meeting every night, just about. And I wasn't drinking. I was going to meetings. And I wasn't drinking. And I was going to meetings. And I was staying sober. But I was starting to get... I don't know. I was starting to get... something wasn't right. I felt like I wanted to drink, and I was having all these, cravings was not the right word. It was the obsession of the mind, I guess is what it was, because I kept thinking about drinking, and I didn't know anything about the steps, and I was getting ready to drink one night, and I marched out of, I remember I was in a meeting, and I marched out of a meeting after about 10 or 15 minutes. I had a resentment towards somebody in the meeting. There was this old man, and he had this he had this wandering eye, and he had this eye always was looking at me, and I didn't like the fact that his eye was always looking at me. What, the eye that was really looking was over here, I'm sure, but that one eye was over here, and it followed me everywhere I went. And old Curtis, he was tough as they come, old Curtis. He was a drunk. He got sober on the streets of Harlem, and he'd gotten sober in 1952. We'd gotten off heroin in 1952, and he was as rough as they come. And he would call me on my stuff, and he would scream across the room at me, you know, if I was saying something that was, you know, not right, he would say, you're full of, you know, and I'm not going to repeat the word from the podium, but you can imagine what it was, the four-letter word. And I mean, he was on my back all the time, and that wandering eye. And so I had enough of his eye. And so I marched out of there, you know, and I'll show them. I turned over a chair and slammed the door. And I was on the other side of that door, and I got terrified. I said, oh, man, what have I done? I'm just totally screwed, you know, pardon my language. But that's what I said, and that's what I felt like. I don't have any phone numbers. I don't have a sponsor. I was about two months sober, I guess, a little bit over 2 months sober. I said, I can't go back in there. I made a fool of myself. What am I going to do? You know, and I thought about going to the 7-Eleven store and getting a drink. And so then the thought says, well, man, you've made it 2 months. You can get through one more day. But I wanted to drink so bad. And I remember somewhere I'd heard to pray. So I started praying real hard. And I didn't drink that night, you know. And the next night I went back to AA, still feeling the same way, restless, irritable, and discontented. And somebody said, you look like you're getting ready to drink. And I said, yeah, I'm afraid I am. I've had enough of this AA. And this girl named Marty said, we have a big book. There's a guy named Al Jacobson. Well, I knew. I'd met Al at the first meeting, and he chased me around the room, and I was terrified of him. He was too intense. He was chasing me around the room at the first meeting with the big book, and I was like, I don't want any part of this. You know, this guy is too intense for me. But anyway, so Marty said, well, Al has a little meeting in Buckingham, and we listen to Joe and Charlie tapes, and he teaches us how to take the steps. And I didn't know what the steps were. Because I was getting to meetings late and leaving early, so, you know, that type. And people had poked phone numbers at me, and I would throw them in the trash. You know, I didn't want any, there was no sponsor for me. I was too unique, you know, too whatever for you people. So, anyway, so I started going to these little big book studies, and it was really neat. I liked it. It started to make sense to me. There was actually something I could do. I mean, being a teacher and a good student, it was actually, you know, I felt like I had homework. We would listen to the Joe and Charlie tapes, and for those of you who don't remember Joe and Charlie, it was a couple of guys that from, where are they, Arkansas somewhere? They went around in the late 70s and during the 80s, and with their, they would do a talk on the steps, and they made the steps come alive, and they had a lot of tapes, and before then, it seemed like that the steps had been hidden in the big book somewhere, and the big book was collecting dust, and nobody really used it, so Joe and Charlie really made the big book come alive, so to speak, and they would explain the big book in a humorous manner, and it made sense. They would go through, start at the beginning, and go through chapter 6, I think, or 7, and so each week we would do a step, we'd listen to a step, and then on the Joe and Charlie tapes, then Al would sort of like translate what it meant, you know, and give us his version of it, and then we'd go home and work on the step and come back, you know, and we had the little chart with the columns, you know, and we'd check the columns and everything, and it made sense, and it was just like, this is not that hard, you know. I mean, there's a lot of work on that fourth step, but it took me about a month, but I did it, and I was using Al as a sponsor. I was just too afraid to tell him, and he was still chasing me around the room. Something started to change, you know. I started doing these steps, even without a sponsor, and I'm sorry, that's the wrong thing. New people, get a sponsor. You know, you can always, if you don't like them, you can always change sponsors, but get a sponsor. I was doing the steps without a sponsor, and I stayed sober, but that just shows me how powerful these steps are. Here I was without a sponsor, you know, and I was still doing the steps, and I got a cousin to do my fifth step with, which was a big mistake. And I did my fifth step with a cousin because I didn't have a sponsor. And she, after I did my fifth step, she called everybody in my family and told everything I'd done bad. And there was some sexual stuff in there. I didn't really want anybody to know. And she told everybody. And so get a sponsor, new guys. Please get a sponsor and do your fifth step with them. Not with your cousin, your crazy cousin Earlene, who was a psych nurse. Psych being the operative word there. Anyway, so after I did my fifth step, I started to get, you know, just like change. I could feel a change. You know, a lot of people say they didn't. I didn't feel any change after the fourth step. I thought I would, but nothing. I didn't feel anything really. But after the fifth step, I really felt like a weight had been lifted off my shoulders, even though it was done with this, somebody was not, it was in another 12-step program. But I started to change, and I started to feel a part of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started to like you guys. You know, I didn't like you before, but I started to like you. I didn't say love, but like. And, you know, and I went on and did the rest of the steps, and I did my amends to the best of my ability. I couldn't remember everybody, but as time went on and my mind cleared, things would come back to me. You know, I'd done a lot of damage to my brain, you know, and was it Sammy says this, I had two brain cells left, and they were waving goodbye to each other so, as we speak. Not a whole lot of what I'm saying is original, but this is my story, I promise you. Nobody else would want it. But anyway, so if you're new, the first 90 days, and you're not feeling well, you're not supposed to. I remember saying, they didn't give me any pills, I didn't take anything, I wasn't offered anything, the doctors didn't offer to give me a prescription for anything, and it hurt. I mean, the first 90 days was a complete and utter hell, you know, it was awful. But I got through it one day at a time, you know, and I remember in early sobriety, I don't know, I had the summer off because I was teaching, and I got sober in June, I went back in September, so I had 3 months under my belt without working, which was good. But I went back just in September. I remember getting off from work and walking up and down the streets of the town where I was living in Blackstone, Virginia, crying because I was so miserable. I didn't want to drink anymore. The desire had been removed after I did my ninth step. The desire had been removed to drink, but I was so miserable. I was just so, you know, I didn't know what to do. You know, I still wasn't really quite sold on this thing, sobriety, you know, and I was really like, I felt like I was on a fence, like, you know, the old world's over here, my old life's over here, the drinking, and then this new life that I don't understand and I'm not used to is over here, and I'm on this fence, and which way do I want to go? And I remember walking up down the streets waiting for the meetings to open up at 8 o'clock and crying because I was so miserable, and I just felt so bad. And I remember that assistant principal that had said that, you know, she knew I was drinking, said, and I told him when I went back to school in September that I'd gotten sober during the summer, and they were all happy and everything. And she said, oh, how are you doing? And I remember I said, I just feel like I'm, you know, I'm just like grasping at straws here. I feel like I'm, she says, you're doing great. You know, she said, everybody says you're doing great. There have been no complaints about you, and you're not offering the students beer anymore, and you're not falling in the trash can anymore. You're doing great, so hang in there, you know. And she's just really nice to me, and I was getting better. I just didn't know it, you know. A lot of times newcomers are getting better, and we can see the light that's come on in their eyes, but they can't see it yet, you know. It's like, oh, this thing doesn't work, oh, but you're doing great. You look great, you know, and the newcomer doesn't always see it. But if you're having a hard time, just hang in there and get a sponsor and that'll take you through the steps, you know. And I always consider Al my sponsor, even though at that time I was too scared to ask him. But I got another sponsor that was my sponsor for 14 years, and it was a wonderful, wonderful woman named Suzanne. And she was a nurse, and she was just really, really a brilliant woman, and she really knew how to handle me, and I think she was what I needed at the time. She taught me a lot, not so much about the big book. I always say I learned everything about the big book and the steps from Al, who's been my sponsor for the last couple of years and had been my sponsor previously. About 10 years ago, he was my sponsor for a year, and then I went back to Suzanne. But, you know, I've had those are the only two that I consider sponsors. But the first sponsor, Suzanne, taught me a lot about just about life and about God. And she, you know, I felt so bad and so damaged, and I felt like, you know, I'd done so many things you know, that went against the laws of God and man, that I didn't think God could ever forgive me. And she taught me that, you know, that God loved me. I was a child of God, and not to be so hard on myself, that, you know, God did love me, and I deserve to be happy, joyous, and free. And she just taught me a lot of things like that. Let's see. But anyway, back to the first 90 days. The first 90 days were the hardest. But after 90 days, things started to change a lot for me. And I remember I just started to take off in this program. It was about 90 days when I was doing my ninth step. So I think it was day 90, and I picked up a 90-day, a three-month chip, and that was when I was in the middle of my or I just finished doing my nine-step amends to these people. And I did these amends to people. I remember I did the hardest one first. And after I did that, it was just so easy to do the rest of them. And like I said, it was years later that some of the biggest amends I needed to make, I didn't even think about for years until years later, and I thought about them. So I guess they came to mind when God wanted them to come to mind. But it's amazing, you know. And I'd like to say that my... I'd like to say that it's all been, you know, a bed of roses, and that all I've done is soar to, you know, lofty heights of Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, and I've helped you humans, you know, on the earth, you know, and I've been up there in the clouds, you know, but it hasn't been like that. I remember I was doing so well for so long that maybe I took for granted that this program was not all that easy, but it just seemed so easy, and I was just like flourishing, doing everything, you know. I was Mr. AA, you know, and no humility, mind you. And that was probably my downfall, because I hit a brick wall. And I was telling Helen a few weeks ago that you know, somewhere in our reading it says sometimes we get to a point where we can't pray, you know, we just can't pray, but it's okay, it's normal, but just get back to praying as soon as you can. Well, I was telling him I didn't pray for about 8 years, and I don't know how I stayed sober. I was doing the first and the 12th step for about 8 years, you know. I was sponsoring truckloads of men, you know, and teaching them the right way, you know, but I wasn't doing it myself, you know, and I just felt like I was a big phony, and it was like I was getting sicker and sicker, and I was getting so sick, and I don't know, I just didn't see it, you know. I don't know if other people saw it, but I wouldn't dare tell the truth to my sponsor, you know. And I was in the time when I was changing sponsors, and I sort of used a sponsor between Suzanne and Al, or Al and Suzanne, that I knew wasn't a very strong person or a very good sponsor. And so I sort of like, I knew I could get away with murder. And I mean, I knew this stuff. And I started lying, and I started saying I was going to 5 meetings a week when I was really going to 1 or 2. Well, no, I never went to less than 2. I'd go to 2 meetings a week for years and say I was going to 5. And I started to lie. You know, and I did some stuff that, I did some stuff that was illegal, and here I was like this Mr. AA. I had this facade that I'm, you know, Mr. AA, and I was speaking every week, and I was doing all this stuff, and here I was just this big phony, you know. And I mean, I'll give you an example of something really horrible. I mean, this is horrible. And my mother was taking oxycodone, and I was selling her oxycodone to make money. You know, I think that's illegal. And here I was with 20, you know, with tons of years of sobriety, and selling her oxycodone and giving her Tylenol, telling her that it was Percocets. And I was selling them, you know, and I did that, you know. And a couple years ago, I got... I knew that I was going to drink, or something was going to happen. I could see the writing on the wall after 8 years of not praying and lying and doing. I mean, that was just one of the illegal things I did. And I mean, I did so many things that I can't talk about. I don't think the statute of limitations run out on a lot of them, but, going to court, getting sued, arrested. I mean, I've done all this stuff in sobriety and having this fake facade, you know. A facade is fake. So I had a facade. And so I knew that I was manipulating my sponsor, and the sponsor, this temporary sponsor, was just saying, oh, all you need to do is go get some medication, go get some antidepressants. And I knew I needed to get rid of this woman. So I ended up sponsoring her for a while. But anyway, I went back to Al. I went crawling back. I said, Al, please take me back. You have no idea what I've been doing, and I need help, man. I need a lot of help. And he took me back. You know, it was never a question of sure. You know, and I've been working with Al for closely for the last 2 years, and he has me on a pretty tight leash. And I made his home group, which meets 3 times a week, my home group, and I'm taking care of my mom. That's been hard. I blamed a lot of myself. Oh, you just don't know the problems I had. I'm taking care of my invalid mother, and that's why I'm doing all these illegal things, you know. And that's why I'm lying. But, you know, I mean, it's just BS. It's just pure BS, you know. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. I can rationalize, justify, and whatever the other one is. And, you know, I can do that, you know. And I even see it, and I still do it, you know. I even see the truth, and I still do it. But it hadn't even been easy going back to Al. You know, we went back through the steps together and the traditions, and then a little bit over a year ago, my brother got sick real quickly, and he lasted 3 weeks. He died of cancer really quickly, and he came home to live. So I was taking care of both of them. Both my mom, who's in the wheelchair, and my brother, who was bedridden, and I was working 40 hours a week at my job, and I really was going to five meetings a week at that point, and sponsoring 6 men, and, you know, going to 5 meetings, and doing all this stuff, and I stayed sober, and it was hard. It was really hard to watch my brother die, so I don't have any other siblings. And then I got through it. I don't really remember a whole lot from that period. It was sort of like I didn't get a whole lot of sleep, but I got through it, you know, and with God's help and with Al's help and you guys' help. But, you know, I'd heard that we can get through anything, you know, so I really believe that we can get through anything, because I haven't, you know, had a drink since it'll be 21 years if I make it to June, but it's really a day-at-a-time thing, and I try not to think about, let's go home. I've said enough. That's all I've got. Let's go home and watch TV.